Les colloques du Collège de France.
And so now we'll change gear again. And so Jérôme Gros, who is coming from Institut Pasteur across Paris, is going to tell us about gastrulation in sheep embryos, I presume.
Okay, sorry. Thank you. Thank you, Thomas, for the kind invitation. We're a developmental biology lab. So today I'm going to focus on this guy here, which is a quail embryo, which is our favorite animal model. And so what you can see that what happens when you take a quail egg, which has been just laid, and you put it in the incubator. So you can see here the massive tissue movement that leads to formation of the primary axis here. The head will be there eventually, and the tail here. So I'm going to try to explain how we think these movements are controlled and how we think they contribute to the self-organization of the embryo. So before I start, I should acknowledge the people that actually did the work. So this is a project that was started with Mehdi Sadawi, postdoc in the lab, followed up by Paolo Caldarelli, and completed now by Aurélien Villedieu, postdoc also in the lab. And this is a complete collaboration with Francis Corson and Alex Chamoli at École Normale Supérieure. So they're theoreticians, we are biologists. So, just a few words about building embryonic structures. So the building of embryonic structures is going to involve mainly two major steps. The first one would be a patterning step. And during this step, what happens is that the right gene have to be turned on at the right moment and at the right location in order to give rise to the right cell types. And this is a very important step, which is mostly a genetics problem, where signaling activates the right gene. But there is a second aspect also of building structures, which is the morphogenic step. And here, the problem is a little bit different, because here what you need to do is to turn on the right cell behavior in order to give the tissue its right shape. So even though the process is of course going to involve cells, this is purely a mechanical problem at the end of the day, because this is how the cells are going to generate forces that are transmitted throughout the tissue in order to deform the tissue and give it its shape. So so traditionally these fields are studied independently, and when I started my lab, I was really considering the fact that patterning is controlling the morphogenesis, and this is a downstream event. But very quickly we realized, especially looking at these movies, when we see all the cells moving, you can only realize that the morphogenesis is going to feedback on the patterning, and it is going to influence the patterning. And there is more and more evidences nowadays that the mechanical forces themselves are actually going to modulate gene expression, and that's something that I'm going to talk about today. So what is also very interesting here, that this reciprocal interaction between morphogenesis and patterning are intrinsically self-organizing. And I'm going to talk about that right now, give a broad introduction about self-organization, because it's a little bit overused word sometimes. So the idea of self-organization is that you have interaction, cellular interaction, so at the local or the long-range scale. And these interactions are going to drive the emergence or the organization of a pattern at the larger tissue scale. And Alan Turing in 1952, the famous mathematician, proposes that this interaction could be mediated by molecules. So he proposed that if you have an activator, diffusible, that self-amplifies itself and induces its own inhibitor, if this inhibitor diffuses faster and therefore further, then you can break symmetry and you can create the emergence of this pattern. That's what's represented here. But what is important in this system is that all the cells from the ensemble here contain all the information to organize, so to self-organize. So, and if you perturb the system here, such by separating two parts of a tissue, let's say, what happens is that the tissue can re-break symmetry and also can rescale in order to match the new size of the tissue. And these are two important outcomes of self-organization. So Alan Turing, in his initial paper, mentioned that it's going to focus only on the molecular aspect, the chemical aspect on morphogenesis and self-organization. But he recognized also that mechanical forces are going to make the problem even more complex, alluding to the fact that mechanical forces can also act as a signal during self-organization. And most studies, subsequent studies, focus on the role of molecules, but there are a few studies at the theoretical level that investigated the role of mechanical forces. But this study mostly, until very recently, this study focus were mostly theoretical, and it's really unclear how forces participate in self-organization. So that's what we're interested in today. And the system that we worked on is gastrulation. So a few words for non-developmental biology, what gastrulation is. So gastrulation is the process by which the embryo, which is just a monolayer initially, becomes a three germ layered. So what happens that you have internalization of the tissue at the midline that I showed at the beginning, which is called the primitive streak in amniotes, and this is where the tissue internalizes and becomes the mesoderm, that would be your bone and muscle later on, or if it goes even deeper, that becomes the endoderm, that would be the guts mostly, and what doesn't get internalized remains at the surface and will be the neural system and the skin. So now, if you look at different organisms, the gastrulation come in different size and in different shapes. And the reason why we like to work on the quail, it's not because we like birds only, it's because really the quail has a size which is very similar to the one of the human, and the geometry is very similar. You can see it's a flat disc here, both, and with our human embryo and chicken or quail embryo, and they also have a primitive streak very much like the human do. Whereas the mouse is considered mostly derived animal when it's when we talk about gastrulation, because the size is very small and it doesn't develop as a flat disc, but instead as a cup shape. So the process might be indeed very different morphogenetically. So that's one of the reasons. The other reason is that because the embryo are adapted to develop externally, we can very easily take the embryo out of the egg and we can make live imaging, so which means that we can capture very nicely the dynamics of development. And I did my postdoc on mouse and I tried to do that on mouse, and it's very, very difficult to do the live imaging in mouse. Of course, it's doable, some people are doing it, but it's really like a massive challenge to do. So we decided to stick to the quail. Another advantage, which I did not realize at the time, as I said, we're a biology lab, and is that we can actually, because the embryo is accessible to live imaging, we can also manipulate the embryo. So we can come and perturb mechanically the embryo. And that allows us not only to, you know, be spectator of the tissue movement, but also to really understand how the movement are controlled, what are the forces which are controlling the movement. So what we did when I started my lab was to develop a quail house facility. So briefly, why a quail and not a chicken, which is more common model, is because the chicken are much bigger, so they're impossible to house in a lab, but the quail is much smaller. And also the other main advantage is the generation time. So chicken generation time is 6 months. So that means they would take you 2 years and a half to make a transgenic line, but the quail is only at 2 months. So it's really like a mouse, but with the size of a rat. So that's what we did. We started the facility about 10 years ago now. We have animals, so we can have a transgenic line. That's what we did. And we have many transgenic lines in order to label the cells and to visualize the cells. And we have reporter for membrane to see the cell shape. We have reporter for nuclei to track the cells. We have also promoter-specific transgene, actin, myosin reporter. So we have many lines, and we have stopped to make lines, and we're trying to make use of the one we use right now. We also participated to the sequencing of the genome, and we created also resources in order to be able to manipulate the genome eventually of the quails, because you need the genome if you want to do, you know, a loss of function, or even to do a simple in situ hybridization. So that's what we've done. So this is thanks to Olinda and Carol, who are engineering the lab and making sure that we make new lines and that we are keeping them. So now, avian gastrulation, so in chicken or in quail. So we know for a long time that, you know, the movement that I showed at the beginning, this massive rotation of vortices happen in the embryo. And this has been discovered about a century ago. And what people show is that you have, you know, a forward movement here and these vortices. And more recently, the lab of Claudio Stern and Keith Wager have shown that the reason why you get the primitive streak that forms at the posterior part of the embryo here is because you have mediolateral intercalation. So cells here intercalate mediolaterally, and this leads to the extension of the primitive streak where the cells will ingress. So we have no problem with that. We see exactly the same thing. But when we started the lab, the real question we were wondering is really, why do the cells come back? So why do they recirculate and come back to the primitive streak? So, and this poses a conceptual problem here because this movement takes place in an epithelial sheet. So all the cells are connected to each other by adherence junctions. So we were wondering, how can you have like such large-scale movement? So the embryo, I should have said that it's 5 millimeters across. So it's really big, and the movement are massive. So how can you get massive movement when all the cells are supposedly cohesive? So that's the flow that we see in the embryo actually resembles the flow that you see in a dish when there is a fluid, and you apply a force toward the center. And now, if you're trying to understand, you know, how hundreds of thousands of cells are regulating their behavior in order to do this, display this movement, it's very complicated. But if you look from a biophysical perspective, it's very much more simple. I forgot to say, I should mention that the analogy to fluid mechanics has been pervasive from the very first description. And so we're not discovering that it's a fluid mechanical problem. People have proposed it. But the problem is really, what is driving the mechanism here? As I said, it's very difficult if you take it from a cell biology perspective, but from a physics perspective, it becomes very much more simple. So all we need to find here is that what is the force driving the tissue flows? What is the material property of the embryo? Is it the one of a fluid? And what is the boundary condition? Because here, what shapes the flow in the dish is really the boundary condition on which the fluid hits the border and then recirculates. That's what we decided to do. And then to identify what are these parameters in the embryo. So this is just to show a movie from our other lab, but we were doing exactly the same movie. This is the kind of movie that we were getting before. So people were labeling sparsely the cells with electroporation, and then, which is a way of transfecting cells, and then we're imaging. And this is the quality of the movie that people could get, and now this is the kind of movie that we can get, thanks to the quail. So we can image all the cells of the entire embryo. You can see cells which are dividing. You can see the primitive streak, which is forming right there, with the cells converging, extending, and this is where the axis will form. So very quickly, we were able, with the quails, to do some very pretty movie, but very quickly we realized that we need more than pretty movies, but we need to make sense of these movies. And that we needed quantitative analysis and biophysical approaches. And that's when we met Francis Corson. So together, we improved the imaging, we adapted the imaging, and developed the tools to really go after this movement. And for example, it adapted to our images, particularly image velocimetry, which is a way that physicists use to track normally fluid in motion. So now I'm going to jump straight to the conclusion, because this paper has been published a few years ago now. But the idea here, if I play the movie again, is that the reason why you get these vortexes in the embryo is because you have an actomyosin ring that develops at the interface between the embryo proper, which is at the center of the disc. This will give rise to the embryo itself. And there is a ring here which will give rise to the extramedullary tissue. And right at the interface between the two tissues, you have these cables of myosin that develop here. So there is another source of motion before I go into the cables. It comes from the epiboli. So the epiboli is the process by which the edge of the epiblasts are going to crawl on the vitreous membrane. So the vitreous membrane is the membrane that holds the yolk, and the disc is attached to the vitreous membrane, and the edges crawl on this membrane. And this create the expansion of the extramedullary tissue. So when Francis put these forces, I forgot to say, but the reason why you get the flows here is because the cells, the actomyosin ring contracts at the posterior, while it extends at the anterior, and that's what generates the vortexes. And when Francis put this set of forces in a fluid mechanical model, he could replicate the tissue flows but also the deformation, so breathe expansion and the contraction, with an accuracy of 90% compared when we compare the model to the embryo. So the reason why I'm saying that the model is quantitative, it's 90%, it's because we think the system is in 2D, it's very simple, and we think we have identified the mechanical properties and the forces that actually drive the entire process very accurately. And now to conclude this part, which is necessary for the second part, so yes, we believe it is, we have shown that it's a mechanical problem, but it's not like the analogy of the fluid in the dish. So we don't have an external force. Here, that's me blowing on the milk here, but here in the tissue, we don't have external force, but it's an active effort of the tissue, where you can see thousands and thousands of cables here, which will be labeled by fosfomyosin, and these cables contract, and that's what generates the force that drives the tissue movement. So the material property, we could propose that it's actually driven by cell division. So that's something we showed before, that cell division, each time a cell divides, and you can see if I play the movie again, you would see that the cells, it's like the tissue is boiling. Cells, all the cells are dividing, not at the same moment, but they divide and separate. And they reshuffle constantly the neighbors. So we could show that if you inhibit cell division, the theory predicts that it's like increasing the viscosity. And that's something we're actually measuring right now, which I won't talk about today, measuring the viscosity of the tissue in control and cell division inhibited. But we think we have a good idea that it's cell division and the rearrangement driven by the cell division, which is fluidizing the tissue. So now the boundary condition, which shapes completely the flow here, is not relevant in the embryo active because the border actually moves because of the epiphyte very quickly away from the embryo proper. So this is not the boundary which is shaping the flow here, but this is really the active forces and their distribution which are really shaping the flows. So now that explained. I'm sorry, I'm missing a very important slide here. So so this explained very nicely how you get the embryo into shape, but we thought that this explained very also could explain also how the embryo self-organizes. And for this, I need to explain this experiment, which was performed about not a century ago, but 60 years ago. And here, what people were doing, Lutz and Spratt, they were actually taking embryo, the same stage as I was showing before, and they were actually subdividing the embryos. So they were doing what they knew how to do, that was no molecular biology, and they were cutting and pasting. So they cut the embryo into two pieces, and they were actually separating and letting the embryo develop in culture. So what happens when you do that, and it's a very striking phenotype, is that the embryo here develops at the posterior side completely normally. So the embryo, that means that the embryo is able to rescale to the new size of the tissue. So imagine that we're removing about 50,000 cells. And then the embryo is able to redirect the territories in order to form an embryo with a head and neural driven somites. But perhaps what is most striking here is that the other half, which should have never formed an embryo, now starts to form an ectopic embryo. And this has been called embryonic regulation. But this is not really mentioned in the literature up till now, but it's really, we think, a destabilization of a self-organized process here. So, more recently, the lab of Claudio Stern has shown that GDF1, which is a secreted molecule, a TGF-beta molecule, is expressed at the posterior part where the primitive streak would form, where the cells contract. And here, what he could show here, that when you cut an embryo, that GDF1 is normally expressed, and it's necessary and sufficient to drive the formation of the embryo. But when you look at the anterior part, where there is no GDF1 normally, suddenly GDF1 reemerges. So the question is really, how can, to understand the self-organization at this stage, how can you retrigger the formation of the emergence of GDF1 expression? So a model has been proposed here, and the idea here is that you have GDF1 in purple here that would secrete its own inhibitor, and the inhibitor would diffuse farther away from the source. And then when you cut the embryo in half, what happens is that you separate the anterior part from the source. So now the inhibitor can be washed away, but because there is no source, there is no inhibition, and then you drive the expression of TDF1. So we have no problem with this model. This is sound, but the problem, I mean, we have a little bit of a problem indeed, but it's the dynamics. So the inhibitor is sound, but the dynamics is very unrealistic, because what happens here that you get expression after 2 to 3 hours. So it's very difficult to believe that the embryo, which is about 5 millimeters across, is going to wash away the inhibitor and trigger the expression of TDF1 within 1 hour or two. So, but what we thought at the time is that TDF1 is expressed exactly where the cables are sitting here. So what we thought is that maybe the inhibitor is not molecular, but it could be mechanical. The whole idea here would be that you would have a modulation of TDF1, which drives the embryo formation. And the contractility could be the positive activator of TDF1, positive modulator, and the tension, where the cells are being, you know, under tension in the anterior, would be the negative regulator, the inhibitor. What would happen that when you release the tension of the, when you cut the embryo, you release immediately the tension that is running around the embryo. So, and this is much more believable to us because forces travel a million times faster than molecules. So that would make complete sense. At least, so how do we test this hypothesis? In order not to make a mistake, I'm going to switch my actual presentation. Really sorry about that. So that was the idea. So the first thing that that Francis did was to go back to the embryo here and to check for the dynamics, the quantitative dynamics at the margin, because this is where the active things are happening. All the rest follows here because of passive fluid mechanics, propagation of the forces. So what he did here was to check the profiles of velocity. So this is the profile here. So zero here, it's a linear, unfolding linearly the margin here. And the zero here would be the posterior, and the edge would be the anterior. So it's really unfolding and looking at the dynamics. So what you could see here, what was striking, is that you have a triangular velocity shape here. And this is striking because the cells are either have a preferred velocity here. So another way to look at the same data is to look at the derivative of the velocity here, which would be the strain rate. And this is exactly the same thing, the same graph here, except you're looking at the time here, the position here, zero is the posterior. And what we could see that the tissue at the posterior is in red, constantly contracting. And the tissue, which is at the anterior, is constantly being stretched. And that was very striking because the tissue is constantly moving. So even though you have flow, advection, and the tissue is forming the streak, you keep a contracting domain in the posterior. So this is very striking because that means that you have two states, two mechanical states, one which is constantly contracting, one which is constantly being stretched. And this is really resembling, you know, breaking symmetry, not at the molecular level, but at the mechanical level. So how can we explain that? So Francis came up with the idea that now, so I like myself to take the analogy of the rubber band. So imagine you have a rubber band and you start to make a local contraction at the center of the rubber band. So the tissue, I mean, the rubber band will contract at the center, but will drive the tension throughout the entire rubber band. So now that means that contractility can induce tension. Now if you pull on this rubber band, and then you can counteract the tension, the contractility. So that means that the tension can act as an inhibitor of contractility. So all we need here to be in presence of mechanical analog of Turing is to have contractility which is self-activating. And that has been shown in other systems, including Drosophila with the work of Thomas, that if the cells contract, can deform the tissue in the cell next to it and can actually induce its contraction. So now, when Alex came in, they decided to build a model of it, and what he showed is that now if you take the same model that we have here, but now you put only this interaction here in the model, so magenta is the contractility, which we know we have a bias in the posterior, and green is the tension, and the black is the velocity that we see from the experiments. So this is the prediction of the model. So this is a 1D vision of the model, and this is what it looks like. If you look at the derivatives again, so the strain rate, well, we can see that we can recapitulate with this interaction, this bimodal state, where you are either contracting the posterior or extending in the anterior. So then, this is 1D view of the model, and this is a 2D view. And you can see that just this interaction is able to recapitulate the flow that we see in the embryo when you put them in the fluid mechanical model. So just to explain a little bit more how the model works, this is a simplified view, but the idea that you have actomyosin cables all along the embryo, at the interface with the embryo and the extramedullary tissue, And what happens is that the cables induce a tension which is uniform almost along the entire margin. So now in the posterior, the cables, the force that they are generating is greater than the tension that they generate. So what happens is that the tissue now contracts in the posterior. And this acts as a positive feedback now to stabilize the myosin cables and to recruit new cables. And that's how you maintain the contraction that keeps going in the posterior. Now, in the anterior, that's the opposite. Now the myosin cables, this is assumptions, we don't know how, we don't know if that's actually the case, that's how the model works. That would mean that the cables now are there, we know they are there, but we don't know their dynamics really. But the idea would be that now they're being stretched, so they're being destabilized, so they're not able to make the tissue contract, but they participate to transmission of the force. So that's how the model works to keep these two mode constant. So now if you want to look at the equation, that means that the contractility is regulated through modulation by strain rate, and there is also an advection term because the tissue is moving, and there is also diffusion to allow for non-locality of the contractility. That's how the model works. So now that explains very nicely how you shape the embryo. So this interaction will give you a primitive streak. But does it explain if it triggers GDF1 expression? That's the next question we wanted to address. So in an intact embryo, what we did was to inhibit the contractility, showing just the result, not the movies, but we can inhibit the contractility so the tissue doesn't move. The embryo is not dead. It's still spread, so that's it's not killing the embryo, but we lose the contraction of the cells, and we lose completely the expression of GDF1, which is normally expressed posteriorly. Conversely, when we increase the contractility through an inhibitor, which is an inhibitor of myosin phosphatase, so basically it stabilizes where myosin is active, and what we see that you can, so the tissue massively contracts, and then you see that you have an expansion of GDF1 expression. So that works, so that means that yes, the self-organized tissue dynamics can modulate GDF1 expression to trigger the formation of a single embryo. Now, does this model, which explains single embryo, can explain how we get, you know, ectopic expression of GDF1? That's what we decided to test, because then you get GDF1 and the embryo completely developed afterwards. So I just want to talk briefly about the statistics of this experiment, because this is like very, very interesting. I'm not going to go through all the experiments here, but what they did was cutting into many different parts, many different orientations, different stages, and they came out with the idea that at the margin that we see, the embryo margin, there is an embryo forming potential with a higher potential in the posterior, which decays when you go to the anterior. So, and this really, you know, resembles the gradient of contractility that we see in the embryo. But now, if I explain one experiment, that would be the one bisecting, which is a classical one, and what people, what they show here, that if you cut 100% of the time, you will get an embryo forming from the posterior. But if you cut in the anterior, it's not all the time. You get 50% in the case that doesn't work. You get nothing. And then you get 25%, an embryo appearing on the right, and 25% of the cases, an embryo appearing on the left. And this is unclear. That's been called a random process. But now the model, the same model that explained the flow and in the embryo, predicts here that if you cut the embryo, because you have a gradient of contractility, you have a bias, and the embryo should form rather from the edges rather than from the opposite side. That's an outcome of the model. This is the 2D model made by Alex, and you can see the two foci contraction as soon as you release the tension, which is the inhibitor, the tissue will contract. So that's the model. We should get two embryos, not one on the right, left, but two embryos. So is that how do we do that experimentally now? That's the work of Paolo that showed that if you, so what he did, very tedious experiment, because he did imaging embryo here, would plot the velocity fields so that we can accurately, and that's very important, plot the anterior-posterior axis of the embryo. We do laser cut to be extremely precise according to this orientation, then separate anterior and posterior part of the embryo, and when would monitor tissue deformation, fix the same embryo and do RNA scope or in situ hybridization to detect gene expression. Very important that we keep exactly the same embryo to match the deformation and the gene expression. So that's what we did, separated anterior halves, and that we see was really problematic because we didn't see never an embryo forming at the anterior part. So it took us, and you can see here, the chymograph do not show here any contraction on the side, so that the experiment wasn't working, which was no expression, no snail tooth marker of the primitive streak. So there was a problem, and it took us maybe a year to figure out what was happening, because we thought that almost, you know, the embryo is not competent indeed to form an ectopic embryo here. So what we realized here that actually what happened that the entire embryo, even the embryo proper, becomes blue and expands. So we thought that maybe the problem was that the epiboly, which is a crawling induced by the vitin membrane, is actually contracting the contraction. So what Paolo did was to do exactly the same experiment, but removing the edge, because that's the edge which crawls that provokes the expansion of the embryo. And what he did that, we can see, difficult to see on the movie here, maybe here, the epiboly catches up eventually, but it gives a little push so that the cables can contract, and we actually get two embryos, which is, this is the same embryo here, chymograph, you can see two contractions, and this is nail to which labels the primitive streaks. We can get two embryos. If you're perfectly, you have to be perfectly dissecting the embryo into anterior and posterior part. Then this relies on actomyosin dynamics, here on contractility, because when we put H152, which is an inhibitor of actomyosin contractility, the embryo, as I said, expand, but we never get a contraction, we never activate the ectopic expression of GDF1. This is what we show here, that's what I just said. Everything relies on GDF1, this is an earlier movie, this is a late movie, this is an earlier movie. We can see that the activation of SNEL2 here is driven very quickly by GDF1 expression. So now going back to the statistics, what we think is happening is that actually when you're perfectly symmetrical, you can't get an embryo out of it. So, but maybe what matters is, you know, this were done by orienting the embryo just by visual inspection, but we can do it much better with, looking at the velocity fields. So now what we think that maybe there is a bias here, that's actually what Paolo tested, making cuts with a bias. I'm not showing the data, but you can see that when he cuts with the bias, he always get, you know, an active portion here, and always get an embryo always on the left. And when you cut with the bias on the other side, we'll always get it on the right. So we can only speculate for what other people have done, but at least we know that's how we get ectopic embryo. They're not random. They just, you know, they're just biased experimentally. Now, finally, the last thing that we were wondering, that nobody has checked, is that the same model of self-organization could explain equally how the embryo rescales in the posterior. Because, as I said, this is an outcome of self-organization. And because here we know that the embryo will rescale and the size of the tissue will rescale to say the new shape of the new tissue. So what the model predicts here is that if you cut the embryo and you get rid of the anterior part, what happens is that you cut, the embryo reattaches, so tension is being reinstalled, and then the tension, being the negative feedback, will decrease the size of the contractile domain to induce a primitive streak, which is at the eventually of the size. So that's what you see here. So if you remove the tissue here, that you rescale the contractile domain and you have a new blue domain. So the movie played too fast. That's what you can see here. So what we did experimentally, cutting, we let the embryo reattach and then we get, you know, a blue domain which reappears. And this is just to compare. Now you're losing the blue tissue, and after the cut, blue tissue reappears. So that means that, yes, the embryo is able, the mechanical domain, I should say, are able to rescale when we cut the embryo. But this is correct only if the embryo reattaches. Because if the embryo doesn't reattach, then the tension cannot be installed. So then there is no inhibition, and the contractility should, you know, not being done. Downregulated here. So that's what the model predicts here. We have a contractile domain that keeps contracting and contracting. And then experimentally, that we prevent the attachment of the embryo, and what we can see here, that exactly they match the model. So the tissue keeps contracting and contracting. And then in the end, we have no stretched domain that reappears. So this is, again, it's like the tissue doesn't feel that it's missing half of it because there is no sensing on the boundary. So then we checked for gene expression. So these are the same embryo. So this would be attached boundary here. So they are the same embryo tissue deformation. We check for gene expression, and that we see that the along with the mechanical domain, GDF1 expression also rescales. And what we see that not only GDF1, but also all the other embryonic territories, because GDF1 is a stream of Bracuri, which is a marker of endoderm. I'm finishing. So that's so what it means is that not only the mechanical domain rescales, but also the genetic expression rescales with the domain. So that's something that we're trying now to address, whether it's just getting a smaller domain or rescaling. So we're trying to manipulate the shape of the embryo. So I'm not going to show that too much, but we, varying the extent of the ablation, we can try to see if we can rescale the domain with a different with the same proportion. Just want to show the last experiment, because these are very invasive experiments. You're cutting embryo into pieces. So, and I was very worried when we were doing this experiment, you have a wound healing response, because we see always GDF1 being highly expressed here in the, at the edge. So what we did was to realize that you can get the same effect if you had not a cut, but a friction along the margin. And here the idea that if you have a friction with an obstacle, then the tension can propagate, and then the cables just beneath behind the obstacle can actually contract now, and that should result in the formation of new embryos. That's what the model predicts here, new contraction just behind the hair. Experimentally, what we did was to put a hair. We tried many different things, but only the hair experimental only worked. We tried many things, but only the hair mainly worked. So what we see here, the hair, no cut, that's very important. When we play the movie, this is deformation. So what you can see is that the tissue, the motion is dragging along. So there is no propagation of tension as we expect. And now the tissue is able to contract just beneath, just behind the hair. That's what we see with the chymograph. And I think this is I love this experiment because it shows that as soon as you put the hair, you see that next to the hair, you induce a contraction of the cables. And that means that we can, that's the same embryo, exactly the same one. We can get GDF1 expression re-emerging where it shouldn't be expressed. And this triggers expression of GDF1, triggers the expression of BRCA, which triggers all the entire genetic program to form an embryo. So I'm finishing here. So yes, there is a self-organized tissue mechanic that impinges on gene expression to induce the embryo formation. We can explain why you get only one embryo in intact formation, why you get two ectopic when you cut an embryo, why you rescan the posterior, and we even come up with a new experiment coming from the model that can explain all of this in one embryo without being invasive. So final conclusion here, that mechanics, yes, can explain how you get the embryo into shape, owing to fluid mechanics here, but also how, by impinging on gene expression, can refine patterning, but also redirect completely patterning in case of perturbation. With this, I'm going to thank, I think, all the people involved. I thank the lab, the entire lab, and the funding bodies. Thank you.
Retrouvez tous les contenus du Collège de France sur www.college-de-france.fr.